Welcome, everybody. This is Then and Now. I'm Brad Sham, and we are delighted to have an opportunity to sit today with the one and only Mr. Cowboy. Now, there's a lot of popular players in the history of the Dallas Cowboys franchise, but when one says Mr. Cowboy, everybody knows that means Bob Lilly. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Brad. Nice to be here.
You know, the first thing, well, I know it's nice to be here because we're doing this in your home. And so it's nice
for you to be here.
For you to let us in. Thank you. Now, here's the first thing I want to ask you. Astonishing to me. You may throw me out after I say this because I did a little math, which always hurts my head. Anybody listening to this who is 45 years of age and younger probably never saw you play. That's mind-boggling to me. And so there's a generation of fans who are actually, and I know this because I've talked to some, who are hungry for information about Bob Lilly because all they know is the name. So what the first thing I want to ask you is, 40 years from removed from your playing days, roughly, how does it feel to still be Mr. Cowboy?
Well, it really does. It's kind of a magical thought to me because I never even really thought about it. I mean, Roger said that a few times back in practice, way back when we were Roger Staubach, back when we were playing, and he was just saying, you know, July B, you were the first draft choice, so and so, and I never thought anything about it. When we had the draft, it wasn't a big deal. It was nothing. The Texans had already drafted me. The Cowboys also drafted me. The Texans are now the Chiefs, for those of you that don't know. But they had drafted me number two and E.J. Hallam number one. The Cowboys drafted me number one and E.J. Hallam number two. And so anyway, during the first two or three years, I kind of wished I had signed with the Texans because they drew a bigger crowd, had a better team.
In Dallas.
They were in Dallas.
Texans that's playing at the Cotton Bowl also, right?
Yeah, plus they drafted mostly Southwest Conference and nearby, like Oklahoma or some of the teams nearby Dallas, they drafted a lot of their players, which were more my age. The Cowboys had the first draft they ever had was after the draft, so the teams found out the AFL was coming into Houston and Dallas and so they were stocking teams up in California and other places. And so they wanted Dallas, especially, to have a pro football team. So they had to rush to get one going. There was not time for them to draft and get the coaches and get the facilities and so forth. So anyway.
Which is why you are the first draft choice in franchise history, yeah. And your career didn't start till 1961.
Right.
Okay.
I was not here the first year.
Right.
But when we got here, next year, I mean, when I got here, went to training camp my first time, I felt like I was a go hand me this boy. All those guys were older. They were like 8 or 10 years older than all of us that were drafted that year. And Glenn Gregory played at SMU, was my roommate. And anyway, Larry Dawson, that was a quarterback at TCU, he was a cowboy, a rodeo cowboy. But he went to training camp because Coach Landry thought he could make a really good strong safety, which he could have. But I left from that training camp and went to Northwestern to play in the pro football champion college all-star football game. So I was gone.
That was the one in Chicago.
We had 4 weeks of two-a-days. I got out of 2 weeks of two-a-days in St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, to go to Chicago and have 2 weeks of two-a-days there.
And who coached the All-Stars?
That was Otto Graham.
Otto Graham. And you played the Packers?
We played the
NFL champions. Pittsburgh?
Not Pittsburgh, but Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, okay.
Norm Van Brocklin.
Oh, gosh almighty.
Yeah, and so anyway.
Welcome to the
I
NFL.
I think Ringo, or one of those, had been traded from Green Bay or something. He was faster and quicker than anybody I'd ever seen. And they had me playing tackle. And I don't think Otto, he called Coach Landry, I think, and he said, I don't know about this Lily kid, said, sometimes he looks great, but he said, I don't know. I think he might ought to just get him a ticket directly home. He called Gil Brandt, what he did. And so, anyway, they put me in a game, though, and I think I got to play. And I think I'm the only one that got over two sacks, a couple of fumbles, several tackles. So after the game, Otto and there was a guy named Stanfield, and they came by and they said, Bob, you don't worry about what all this crap you read. Said, you're going to do fine in the NFL. So I went back, felt good about it. But anyway, it was, you know, being drafted number one I didn't even know what it meant. There was no big TV. There weren't people, agent. We didn't have agents. Nobody was on the phone to call you. The next day when it came out in the paper, Lily was the Cowboys' number one draft choice. Everybody said, well, I guess you were number one draft choice. And I'm thinking to myself, nobody's told me, you know, they haven't called me yet. Finally, Gil Brandt called and said, Bob, you know, we drafted you number one, and we probably need to negotiate a contract. Well,
now here you're at TCU.
I'm at TCU. And I said, well, that's fine. I had no idea what to think. I didn't know what they paid. I didn't know what the bonuses were.
Was there even a rookie minimum in 1961?
I think the minimum was as low as they could get.
Yeah, right. Right. And they were good at that.
Yeah, Gil and I still have a running argument. He thinks I made $12,000, and I think I made $11,500. But I was thinking about being a coach, which there were several $7,000 jobs out there, and I thought, you know, maybe it'd be good if I played a little pro football and got some knowledge, some higher knowledge of football, how it's played, and so forth. Let me interrupt you for
just a second, because we're in an era now where kids grow up and they're dreaming of playing in the NFL, and partly it's because of the glamour and partly it's because of the money, and they can see every game everywhere. Now, you went to high school in Oregon.
Well,
right?
I went 1 year, my senior year. I basically played most of my football in Throckmorton, Texas.
Right.
We went up there because it was a drought and we were about to starve to death. And we had kinfolks in near Pendleton, Oregon, who got my dad a job. So we sold our caterpillars and our hay baling equipment and our tractors and our home. And Dad sold his pickup and our decent car. And we saved our 53 Studebaker V8, had a V8 engine. And he built a trailer, and we put whatever we could on there and went to Oregon.
Built the trailer.
He built it himself.
Yeah. All right, so junior year in Throckmorton, Texas, are you thinking about going to college to play football and then being a pro football player?
Actually, I was better in basketball at that time, although I played football real well, but we were a smaller team than all the other teams in our district. So we always were runner-up or third in football, but we won district in basketball most of the time. So anyway, I had lots of people writing me letters about basketball scholarships. But the person who gave me hope was my dad's hero, who was Sammy Baugh. Sammy Baugh grew up in that area,
right,
where I lived.
Right.
And Dad watched him play, used to go to watch him play at TCU and mm-hmm. watch him play in high school because he was a great football player. And then, so anyway, that's why my dad, when I was about 8 or 9, started taking me to TCU football games. So not to watch Sammy Baugh because he was already out, but he knew the guy that, my dad was partially crippled, so they let him in free and they let me go in free. And they said, okay, Mr. Lilly, you just go right ahead and take your son. And he said, if you can, Just find you some seats, and if somebody comes with tickets, just go. There'll be plenty of seats, so don't worry.
And that was your introduction to the sport.
That was my introduction to this. So my senior year just turned out marvelously because we moved. I did well my junior year. I made all district, all by district, and basketball and football. And then we went to Oregon. I went to state. Anyway, in Oregon, I played football. I made All-State in football and basketball and went to state in track. So I got lots of scholarship offers up there. I got a 1-cent postcard from Allie White, who was a line, he was the line coach, offense and defense, at TCU. And he said, we're offering you a, I wish I had that card, but anyway, we're offering you a 4-year scholarship, all tuition and books and dorm and food paid, and you get $10 a month laundry check. And he said, and this is a wonderful school, you'll love it.
Well, that was your recruitment process.
But I was recruited by like Washington, Oregon, Oregon State, Washington State, some team in Idaho. What was it? Jerry Kramer went to, wasn't Idaho.
Boise,
I think. Anyway, I went and visited, you know, but you get up in the, it's always raining over in Western Oregon and Seattle, it's raining all the time. Plus the trees are so darn tall that you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere. And I'm used to being in the plains where I can see a long ways. But they were very nice people up there. And
but then you got that 1 cent postcard with a full ride from
postcard,
TCU.
So to make sure I was so bright back then, I took my dad's 53 Studebaker and another kid that was trying to get a basketball scholarship, and we didn't have a phone, so I called Coach Martin. Abe Martin was our coach. Mm-hmm. I called him from our high school coach's office, and I said, I'd like to come down and just visit with y'all, and show Larry Applegate would like to try out for a basketball scholarship. But I don't think we can afford to come down. We're working right now, and we'd have to take off. He said, lad, he always called you lad. He said, we can pay $150 a piece for your gas and food, which was a lot of money in 1960, 61. He said, you guys come down and visit. So we drove straight through. We didn't have any money to start with, like $20 a piece or something like that, 30 maybe. And we drove, mother made us sandwiches, pimento cheese sandwiches, and a bag of oranges. That's what we had. And so one of us drove and one of us slept until we got to Throckmorton. And so my grandmother, she fed us up really royally. We slept there for 2 nights and then we drove on down, got a haircut, down to TCU. And so anyway, he would have gotten a basketball scholarship, but at that time, since he was out of state, he would have had to pay his own tuition for a year.
You could be in-state because your grandparents were still in Throckmorton?
Well, because I'm from Texas, and I don't know really how that worked. But
yeah.
That's probably
they don't want to know.
They probably didn't want him. I don't know. I never did know. He did go back and get a scholarship in Oregon to a small school.
So at what point while you were at TCU did you think about playing pro football? Only as a means of learning something to become a coach?
Yeah, well,
until you got into the NFL?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But I didn't ever really finish why I...
Because I interrupted
got excited.
You.
No, yeah. I interrupted myself. I got excited about maybe going to college because my junior year I had a good year in Throckmorton. So I got a letter, the only letter, and the only call, and the only... from Sammy Ball, who was coaching at that time. He was coaching at...
in Washington,
at Hardin-Simmons.
Oh, at Hardin-Simmons, okay.
Yeah, that was out by his ranch.
Right, right.
He had a rattan, was where he grew up, and he had a ranch out there. So he coached Hardin-Simmons Baptist University, which is... They had three small schools, McMurray, ACC, and Hardin-Simmons. And so he wrote me a letter and said, Dear Robert, said... You've had a good year in football. We've had scouts watching you and Robert McLeod of Merkle, and we'd sure like to have both of you here on scholarship. And he said, if you have a good year next year, he said, we're willing to offer you a 4-year scholarship. And then he had P.S., you got to have pretty good grades to get in Hardin-Simmons. So that really helped me a little bit because I wasn't a great student, but I upped my grades to a B average anyway. And I found out it only took 30 minutes a day.
Maybe you were smarter than you thought.
Yeah, I don't know. I just sat down there and studied. But anyway, that's where I got the idea that I might go to college.
Uh-huh.
So then when I went to TCU, they signed me while I was down there. And my parents, I heard my mom and dad say, Dad had a minor heart attack, and they were going to move back and live with my grandmother for a short time till he got better, which they did, which then he bought a mail route where he took mail from Throckmorton to Breckenridge to Mentor Wells to Weatherford to Fort Worth and then back, you know.
I wish I had time to do a separate show on buying a mail route, but that's another movie, maybe another time.
Anyway, okay. So it worked out well, and my senior year at TCU, my junior year, I was second team All-American or something, and my senior year I made consensus All-American. We had a senior named Don Floyd when I was a junior. Don was All-American, and then there was a kid from where's he from? We played him in the Hula Bowl, in the Blue Bonnet Bowl, South Carolina.
Anyway,
he was an All-American, and I played against him, and I had a pretty good day. In fact, I got lineman of the game, and so I thought, hell, this may not be so bad after all, you know? So anyway.
And little did you know you could make $11,500.
I know, yeah. Well, they gave me a bonus, too.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they gave me like a $1,500 or maybe $1,800 bonus. And then Herb Adderley got drafted by the Packers the same year, and I think Herb got $20,000 and a like a $5,000 bonus. So the Wynn family, who owned a small interest in the Cowboys.
Bedford Wynn.
Yeah, Bedford, and I think even others had a little. Mm-hmm. They sent me a check for $2,500 to make up some of the difference, which allowed me to not only buy a Corvair, which wasn't one of my smarter moves, and have about $1,500 left over. And so I'll just make this quick. It's kind of funny. So I was driving home. I was going to go home one weekend, and I'm driving down University Drive. That's where the Ford, Chevrolet dealership was. So I was driving down there to get on the Weatherford Highway, and the engine fell out on it just dropped down, and I was screeching along University Drive, and I stopped pretty close to the Chevrolet place, within a half a block. And then they came running out, and they came and pulled me over, and what's the guy?
Was it, now, were you in the old 53 Studebaker?
No, I was in a 60 or 61 Corvair.
Okay.
And the Corvair was that new little bitty car.
Yeah.
It wasn't a very good car. So anyway, the guy that owned that is now Jack. He lives in Weatherford. He's one of our congressmen, I think.
Oh. It'll come to one of us here in a minute. Yeah.
Shit. Anyway, I need stem cells.
We'll get to that.
So anyway, so he was nice enough, and I'm trying to think of the man's name, but anyway, the Chevrolet owner, the owner of the Chevrolet dealership, was nice enough. He traded me up to a four-door Bel Air V8 car, and all he charged me was like $250 to get it ready. Preparation, I guess.
Did you feel pretty fancy?
I felt really like I felt better than I'd felt in a long time. I'd never been in a car like that. But so that's what I got to drive my first couple, 3 years of pro football was that.
Was there a time in those first few years, when you look at it today, we have DeMarcus Lawrence playing defensive end on the franchise tag of $17 million this year, and he said, that's okay, I'll play on that, and we'll work on a longer deal next time. You can look at all of the money in the game now through the lens of where you started. What do you think of all that?
Well, you know, I'm not necessarily unhappy for these guys. I just wish they would take care of it. There's about 50% of them that do and 50% of them that don't. But that money could really help a lot of people. I mean, it could help them, obviously. But I just think about what you could do for your families and, you know, and just, I mean, you could invest it wisely and have a great income. And anyway, they may do that. I think more and more of them are doing that, but a lot of them do go broke early. They go broke, and I hate to see that because, but I don't know. I really don't know what to say about salaries. We would have loved to have more money.
Sure.
There wasn't more money. I know that. The Cowboys actually were borderline profitable. They were profitable a few years. But then I think when by the time Jerry bought them, they were losing money. So it was, you know, it was like when the Texans were here. I know we had to be losing money, even though we didn't have a very big payroll.
Right.
So I don't know what I think about that. I don't think there's near the discipline that we had back in those days as far as an awful lot of the coaches back then had been through the war. And usually on every coaching staff, you had one or two or three guys that had been in World War II when I was playing in the early years. And they were, it was different. I mean, you had rules and regulations, and you followed them.
And you're not talking about the playing rules of the game. You're
talking about
how you live, how right. You present yourself, what you
do. Just what you do in training camp.
Mm-hmm.
We were lights out at 11 o'clock. That was it.
Bob Lilly, some of y'all broke that curfew sometimes.
Some of them did.
Some of them did?
Yeah.
You never did?
Well, we might have turned the light out at 5 after 11, but we tried to never break it.
Okay.
We didn't sneak out. I'll say that. George and I didn't.
Hell, we didn't. That'd be George Andre, yeah. Who was your defensive end, was your roommate.
We were there 6 weeks, and we had six exhibition games.
Right.
We got $43 and something cents was the net after taxes on that. So we had no other earnings. So we had to send that home. I mean, you know, we may have taken out. We finally were making enough. They finally increased the salary enough to where we made maybe I think $400. We thought we were really, really doing something big per exhibition game. And then we were able to rent a car. Like, instead of having four of us rent a car, the two of us could rent a car, and we could rent our own TV for our own room instead of four of us watching.
Say that last part again about having a TV.
Well, we used to four of us go together and rent a TV.
And rent a TV.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that we all had to move our chairs every day in a little bitty room and watch TV. And that's the way, you know, that's just the way it was. And what we did right after practice, because they had good food at Thousand Oaks. I mean, we did have good food, but we never got enough to eat. So as soon as we got through with practice and ran our wind sprints, we ran through those showers quickly and dried off quickly and gotten the four in one rental car. And they had two country western bars around there. And so we would go to one or the other. We tried not to just do it too often, but at least a couple of times to each one a week. And they had free food. And they had a dollar a pitcher beer and all you could eat free. And so we would go over there, but this is like we're done. We're showered, and now they're at 5:15 because we usually got through about 5.
Did you have meetings at night?
Oh, yeah. We had to eat. We had to be back and eat at 6:30, and then we had to be there at 6. So we had about 45 minutes. We could drink two pitchers of beer and eat two plates of food in about 15 minutes and be back over to the dorm and go through the line and eat again.
And check in for your mandatory meal.
And Coach kept saying, you guys he finally put a weight limit on us because we were gaining weight.
You were gaining weight in training
camp. He said, I know you're working hard. I know that. We're working twice a day and you should be losing weight. And so, anyway, we didn't ever mention that. He never did know about it. And we went to one training camp. It was like my second year. We tried something new. Went up somewhere in Michigan, and it was kind of northeast Michigan or something.
Yeah, a lot of Cowboy fans might not know. The first few years, they're Minnesota, Michigan, Oregon.
Two, now they went the first year. I don't know where they went. I know they went to Northfield, but mm-hmm. They went somewhere else at South Dakota or somewhere. But we only went 2 years like that. And even that second year, we went back 2 weeks to Thousand Oaks. That was the first time I'd ever been there. And then from then on, it was 6 weeks and sometimes 7 weeks at Thousand Oaks.
Okay, and so you're in Michigan. You started to...
We're in Michigan, and it's every morning there's frost. There's frost on the ground. If it rained, their mud puddles were frozen. And so we're out there working out in the morning, and it warms up to maybe 45 degrees or something. And so that afternoon, it would be maybe 75 or 80 at the most. And we're gaining weight really fast now. I mean, we're lifting weights too. We started lifting weights. So we're just, I mean, it's like he put a fine on us. You know, it's $25 a pound. And every time you weigh, if you weigh a pound, if you weigh a pound over once, that's 25. The next time, if it's 50, it's 50 if you're 2 pounds over. No, the next time, if it's 1 pound over, it's 50. If you're 2 pounds over, it's 100 because it doubles. In other words, per pound. So Willie Towns got up in the big money.
Willie Towns was a defensive lineman who was a large man. Willie was big boned.
Yep. You know, Willie could have been a super all pro.
He
got hit and he torqued his femur. And it drove the muscle into, you know, when you torque something, the bone separates and the muscle got pinched down in there and it started growing to his thigh bone, or may have gotten into inside his bone, because your bone's not that thick. Anyway, they tried to cut it loose 2 or 3 times and it just wouldn't do that. And he could never run and move as quickly after that. So he didn't make it. But he would have been great, I can tell you that.
You said coach, and I have to ask you to talk a little bit about Tom Landry. What did you think of him when he wasn't Tom Landry yet when you met him. I mean, he wasn't, you know, he was Tom Landry, but nobody outside of the University of Texas where he'd played, he wasn't who he became. What were your experiences with him, especially early?
Well, the first time I ever met him, we had a get-together at Burnett Park. That was where we practiced once we got back from training camp. Burnett Park was right across, you know, where the bridge goes across the Trinity River.
Trinity River in southern Dallas.
And you go on 35, you're on 35. And the first exit there was, I don't remember if it was Davis or what it was, but anyway, there's a blank piece of field there now.
Was it the ballpark where the Eagles played?
Yeah.
Baseball?
It could have been. It was, yeah. Burnett Park.
Yeah, Burnett Field.
Baseball park. But it was like when you go across the river and you get on the other side, there's a vacant land out here that's up from the river, but to get to it is kind of hard. You got to get off and then you got to go around and then you come around. And so we had this meeting set up and I'm late. Because I'm thinking that couldn't possibly be it. Surely we wouldn't be going to a baseball park and run down one at that. So I finally went around the back, and sure enough, it was. There were several cars there. So I'm looking for a door to go in. There's just a big opening. I walk in there and I see light coming out of one of the doors, and I hear people talking. I open it up. And he said, "If that were during the season, Bob, it'd cost you $50." First thing he ever said. Second thing he did, we were all sitting there, and he said, "First of all, I want you to understand." He went through his whole fine book and the rules and regulations of the Cowboys, and then he said, "Later you'll get your defensive and offensive books, which are that thick. But here, these were all the things that you couldn't do and you could do, and what your fine schedule was and all that. Curfews, and everything was spelled out." He was very meticulous. So walk in, and first thing he did, he writes up on the board his priorities in life. And he said, number one is God, number two is family, and number three is football. And I think three or four of us thought our hearts sank because we thought he had his priorities backwards. Anyway, because, you know, you hate to lose. But I guess he had them right. But he chose good character. I mean, for the most part, we had players that really had good character, and they did abide by his rules, and they were pretty strenuous rules for that time. And we worked extremely hard. I mean, these guys today, I don't know if they can make a practice or not. 105 out there, 110, no water. We did that for 9 years till Pettis Norman nearly died, 8 years.
And nobody said it was smart, but that was, those were the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned you hate to lose. Cowboy fans right now think they're frustrated because it's been 20-something years since the Cowboys won a Super Bowl. One of the most iconic photographs in the history of the franchise is you flinging your helmet after the loss in the Super Bowl the year before you won,
Super Bowl
right?
Five.
Would you just talk a little bit about what it felt like to be so close? At least now the franchise has a foundation of having won championships.
Yeah,
y'all
did.
Didn't have that.
No, we didn't.
Then what was that like trying to get over that hump?
Well, it was very difficult. It's funny, I could feel that we were building a team, especially after the second year. That's when we had a really good draft. And we got, I'll just start with George Andrie. George Andrie was one of the best defensive ends playing during my era. People, I don't think he gets that recognition, but he could shut the run down. And he had, at one time, he was a sack leader for our team. He had 20. Well, I think Harvey broke it with 21. And George didn't make mistakes. Then we got Jethro Pugh a couple of years later. Jethro Pugh was a darn good football player. And, of course, we got Willie during that time. And we got Mel Renfro, I think, my third year. We got Cornell Green my second year. We got Pettis Norman my second year. We got Tony Lissio my second year. Mike Gechter my second year. Dave Edwards my second year. Chuck Cowley, my first year, Chuck came.
He'd been with the Bears.
He was in Wheeling, West Virginia. He owned a shop and a FINA service station. And so Chuck evidently Tex got him away from Chicago because he told him he wasn't ever coming back. He got hurt and he couldn't play. The rest of his first year, so he went ahead and decided he wasn't going to play anymore. But he came to Dallas, and he should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion. But we got some good players. We already had Perkins and Meredith and Frank Clark, and we had some good, solid football players. Our defense was lacking, and that's what Coach Landry knew, and so we spent a lot of time on that. But Cornell Green turned into a great safety. And Mel obviously turned into a really good cornerback and safety, weak safety. And then we got Leroy obviously turned into a great middle linebacker, and Dave Edwards played middle linebacker his entire time and was very good at it. And so we really, George Andrie, I mentioned him already, but so we really didn't lack much. I mean, we were building, and I could feel it. Now, those guys didn't know what they were doing the first year, but the second year, we started playing pretty good defense, and that was my third year, fourth year of the Cowboys. My fifth year, we went to the Losers Bowl, we called it.
That's what y'all called it.
We were the runner-up.
The league called it the runner-up bowl.
Yeah, the runner-up in the Western Division, runner-up in the Eastern Division, played a playoff game, and we played in Miami. And we were beaten by Baltimore. And so that was it. We decided, you know, this losing stinks. So we started a weight program. We started a whole, everything started right after that. And we started work. We really worked. Guys were very serious from that point on. We had Craig Martin came in, and we had Renzel come, and Ralph Neely, we got him through the trade, through the Houston, he signed two contracts, one with the Cowboys and one with the Oilers. And we had Leon Donahue and Dave Manders, and then we got Rayfield, turned him into he was a tight end, and he turned out to be one of the best offensive tackles in the league, especially pass blocking. But Fitzgerald, and anyway, those were all probably a little bit later, but they were right after the mid-60s. That's when we started in. So anyway, in 66, we play Green Bay and Dallas, and we play them to go to the first Super Bowl. And They score two quick touchdowns, and we're 14-0 down. We come back, and we outscore them, and we're 7 points ahead going into the last few minutes of the game, and we're on the one-foot line. And Don got bumped and threw the ball, went wobbling, what was the linebacker that got that was?
Robinson?
Robinson. Was it? Robinson, yeah. Intercepted it, and so that was the end of the game. But otherwise, I think maybe we might have beat them. We had them on the roll. The next year, of course, was Ice Bowl. They go to the second Super Bowl. We lose out on that. The next two years, we lost to Cleveland.
In the championship.
Championship game. And then the next year, I think we went to Super Bowl V.
Right.
And we should have won that one, Brad, by. I think we may have done that game together. No, that was after.
No,
I
that
finished.
Was before.
That was after I finished.
Yeah.
That was in Miami.
Yeah, that was in Miami.
That was the Steelers, yeah.
Right.
I remember when I hit the cheerleader.
Yes, yes. But the one you're talking about was O'Brien hit the late field goal, and
right.
It was controversial, and that's when you threw your helmet.
Well, you know, what was controversial was Dave Manders. They fumbled on the one-foot line going in, and we pick it up. He's on it. He's got it. The Cowboys all over him, and they give it to them. And the other one was where the first touchdown of the game, Unanis throws the ball, and one of the Baltimore guys touches it, and then John Mackey.
Which was not legal at the time.
John Mackey caught it and ran it for a touchdown. And they said Mel Renfro touched it. Well, Mel was about 5 feet away. And so they gave him a touchdown there, and then they took one away from us down there. And then we threw two interceptions in the last 3 or 4 minutes. They got 2 field goals and beat us 16-13. Now, that was really depressing. I mean, that was one that we knew we could have won that game.
But it was just the very next year that you did win.
Well, the next year we just made our mind up that we were going to win, and nothing was going to stop us, and nobody cared if they got hurt. They didn't care. We practiced broken arms and broken fingers, and it didn't really matter. So we did.
Remember what that feeling was like when you won that game against the Dolphins?
It felt like, as I've said many times, it felt like a 100-pound weight was lifted off all our backs. But I'll never forget, I had my cigar that I took down to Super Bowl V. My friend from Tyler had given me a Cuban cigar in a little glass. When I took it down, and I was going to smoke it after that game, and I didn't get to smoke it. And so I took it back and put it in the freezer. And I took that thing out of the freezer and took it with me to play in New Orleans. And I got it out, and it was falling apart. So I kind of used glue to glue.
Oh, no.
To hold it together.
You glued together your eventual victory cigar?
Come apart, yeah. And then I had a hell of a time starting it up.
No kidding.
Finally had to borrow a lighter. And I got it to puff. And damn, it was awful.
Yes, I imagine.
But I've seen that thing in pictures.
Oh, well, there's the story behind the story that we never knew. What do you think of the sport today? Do you watch much football?
Yeah, but
I know you follow the Cowboys a little bit.
I watch the Cowboys religiously. I don't watch near as much as I did, Brad. It's just, you know, I might watch a top game. I kind of like to watch New England because they're kind of like the old style.
Mm-hmm.
They're well-disciplined, well-trained. They don't have the best players. They just play with their hearts. And they're very smart, very well trained.
Do you recognize the game? It's such a different game than the one you played, and yet the essentials of it are the same.
Yeah, well, I think it's just the fact that there's so much extracurricular crap that it just takes away from the game. You know, it's just people shouting at each other and, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff. Me. I mean, it just wasn't that way. You never pointed to yourself back when I played.
I wonder if you remember this. You told me a few years after you'd retired how in late 1974 you and Walt Garrison were looking around at the at the new breed of players coming in and how you decided that maybe it was time that you needed to be, y'all needed to be doing something else. You remember that?
Yep. Well, they had an apartment right next to our practice field on Forest Lane where they were smoking pot and doing all that. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm stumbling in on them. Because I thought two or three times at Regal Row, I thought there was a fire going on and it was marijuana coming out from under the door. That was in the 70s. It's like Roger had to go and walk around the 2.5 foot, whatever it is, around to get Texas' attention. Leroy had the big fight with him.
Yeah.
Well, my wife ran off my 2 years before I quit. She ran off with the leading man at the Junior League Follies. And so, I mean, it is kind of funny, but I'm on the USO tour. We're over at Vietnam and all the hospitals visiting all these troops. So we've got a week with our wives back paid for by the USO in Honolulu. So we go back, and everybody's wife was there. Lynn Barney was with me, and Kicker from New Orleans, and I don't know who else. Anyway, four of us, one of them had to go. But anyway, I waited for a day, and then I called. I couldn't ever reach anybody because we had to use a telephone there at the hotel. And finally, about the second or third morning, I got a telegram. I'm sorry, but I've run off with so-and-so, the leading man at the Junior League Follies, and said, I'm sorry you were gone so long. And that was about 15 days or something. And so that, I came home anyway. It
made you look at things a little different.
Yeah, a lot different.
Yeah.
Why am I killing myself? I just took a lot of wind out of me.
I don't want to let all of our time get away without talking about something that, and we've just left out huge chunks, that the photography that's been such an important part of your life. And we'll do another one. We'll sit down another time. But the work that you have been doing to help rehabilitate your shoulder with stem cells that has you leaving the country for treatments from time to time, I know that's something that has been transformative for you physically, and there's some work, some groundbreaking work being done by the NFL, hopefully to apply it to some of the CTE injuries that we're seeing. What, as briefly as you can, what led you to stem cell treatments, and you've obviously found that they work for you, huh?
Yeah, I've felt the results of stem cells, and I've only had. Stem cells three times, but I went. Jackie Sherrill, who coached at A&M and Mississippi State and Pittsburgh and Washington State, which I never knew he coached at Washington State. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he was coaching at A&M when David Eller, was the chancellor. And anyway, David Eller had a good friend in Houston who was a surgeon, back surgeon, and he. He told Dr. Eller he had to go all. He had some sort of back problem, really bad, and he went all over the world and found help so that he could actually be practicing, and he is practicing now. And so they formed a company and started a stem cell company, CellTex. And so Jackie was one of their first customers. Told, I guess, it's my understanding anyway, he had some connections with the head of the NFL.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner?
Yeah, commissioner. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I think at this time they're working some sort of program out. At least they're keeping records and presenting them to the NFL often. And I think there's an interest there from the NFL.
And you've seen, I don't want to mention any names because this is your story to tell, theirs are theirs.
Right.
But you know people who have seen great improvement in cognitive brain function through stem cell transplants,
yes,
right?
Yes, I have seen two or three, and I've seen one especially that has had huge improvement from not being able to write their name or drive a car or get on an airplane and find his way around, who is now 95% cognizant. And I've seen several that have really made improvements. And that's probably part of the protocol from now on. They're going to do a little bit extra this time to me, and that's the intranasal injection that they give you that goes up pretty much into your brain, because we now know that the stem cells can regenerate nerves, and it also regenerates soft tissue. And I'm not sure what the tissue is like in the brain, but I know what it's like.
Hopefully soft.
As far as cartilage, it certainly has rejuvenated my cartilage.
I thought that was, as brief as that was, I did think that was a little better place to wrap up than your first wife running off with the guy from the junior league.
Yeah, you're right.
And that wasn't Ann, by the way. For people who know Bob, it was not the lovely Ann. How long have you and Ann been married?
45 years.
45 years. Let me just wrap up by re-asking the question that I asked you first. We now have a little bit of a look at the backdrop against which you look back at your career and forward. And so how does it feel to be Mr. Cowboy today?
Well, you know, it's like every time I hear it sort of scares me. I don't know what it is. I'm shy to start with. But, you know, I mean, I was reading that trophy up there. It's 75th anniversary all-time team. And I'm thinking, and they've got some dialogue on the side, and I never thought of all that. But, you know, it's like Roger said one time to me. He said, well, you were the first draft choice. You were the first guy in the Ring of Honor, the first guy in the Hall of Fame, and so forth and so on, and first draft pick. And anyway, it just overwhelms me. I feel like there's a lot of people who could be Mr. Cowboy, you know.
And the fact that you feel that way, that's what makes you Mr. Cowboy. Here's a little fun fact, everybody. There's one uniform number that has only been worn by one player in the history of the Dallas Cowboys, 74. And no one will ever wear it again. Bob Lilly, thank you. Always good to be with you.
Thank you, Brad. I've enjoyed working with you for many, many years.
Many years. Many more to come. Bob Lilly, everybody. I'm Brad Sham. This is Then and Now.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.